Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the just-released report from the UN Commission of Inquiry, mandated by the UN's Human Rights Council, that urges the international community to act on evidence that crimes against humanity are state policy in North Korea and that the country's leaders should face justice for unspeakable atrocities. Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and author of Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990, joins us to discuss North Korea's systemic use of torture, starvation and execution that the UN report compares to Nazi-era atrocities. Then Daniel Webster, the lead author of a new report in the Journal of Urban Health that provides compelling evidence of how the repeal of Missouri's background check law has led to an increase in the state's gun violence and murder rates, joins us. He is a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, and we will discuss his report and what kind of national strategies gun control advocates can adopt in the face of dedicated and well-financed opposition. Then finally, we will speak with Gareth Porter, an independent investigative journalist and historian who specializes in U.S. national security policy, about his latest book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of Iran's Nuclear Scare, and the impact of evidence about Iran's alleged nuclear activities that was provided by the MEK. We will look into the key role that this shadowy, cult-like group of Iranian exiles has played in promoting the military option and urging war with Iran, and how they spread a lot of money around Washington, buying a pantheon of prominent bipartisan political clout that recently succeeded in having the MEK removed from the State Department's terrorist list. And joining us now is Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korea Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Good to be with you.
And this report that's just come out from the UN in Geneva, it's devastating. It's basically saying that the North Korean security chiefs and the supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, should face international justice for ordering the systemic torture, starvation, and execution, which they compare to Nazi-era atrocities. And this is an official UN report that's been in the works for some time. I believe the UN contacted Kim Jong-un to let him know about this report. So let's start with the report itself. I've never heard anything quite so devastating as this, have you?
No, this is the most critical, indeed devastating, as you say, report the UN has ever produced on any country. And it lists in great detail, hair-raising detail, atrocities committed at every level, from the top of the leadership to the prison guards to the mid-level bureaucrats. It is really quite extraordinary. None of this by itself, each individual item, is not terribly surprising. We've known about this for years, all of us who have looked at North Korea, but to put it all together in this way is quite astonishing.
So some of the details of women being forced to drown their own babies, children imprisoned from birth and starved to death, families, children informing on their parents who are subsequently executed, families being tortured for watching soap operas. I take it these are soap operas that are smuggled in from South Korea.
Yes, that's correct.
And isn't that the Achilles heel of this regime, that the people who live in this kind of Orwellian bubble of propaganda, ubiquitous propaganda, once they hear about how the people in the South are living, who they're told are living under the yoke of Yankee imperialism, it kind of unhinges them. Is that why the regime is behaving in such a brutal way?
Well, seeing the reality or even the kind of TV dramatization of life in South Korea does undermine the propaganda of the regime for the North Koreans who view it, and we've gotten to the point, this has been going on for over a decade, that North Koreans are able to view smuggled videos from South Korea. It was originally, you know, through VHS and then DVD, but now you can put something on a flash drive and it's pretty difficult to detect. So we're seeing this more and more. The question is, however, how can this translate into any real opposition to the regime? Because as the report details quite explicitly, the surveillance, the security apparatus, the oppression of people's ability to speak out and organize is still very severe. So even if people are becoming increasingly skeptical of the official line, it's still very, very difficult to translate that attitude into any opposition or any criticism overtly.
But also for a communist state, it's a devastating report because it talks about this, essentially this aristocratic structure of the where the elites live in fortress-like privilege, and the rest of the people are, are starving. Of course, there's always been that paradox that this is a communist dynasty, the Kim family dynasty. So are our definitions of it in terms of the left and the right skewed? Because I've heard from Korean scholars who've suggested that it's really not a communist country so much as it's more accurate to compare it to, say, Japan in the 1930s and 40s under the imperial Japanese ruling dynasty.
Well, I'd like to see where a real communist country has ever been actually put together, because I don't think we've ever seen one, at least not one that lasted any length of time, where people were really equal, despite all the ideology to the contrary. I'm going back to Stalin's Soviet Union, which was still a place in which there were elite privileges and many people living in misery. North Korea has always been a very hierarchical society, and this report goes back, as the report points out, this goes back to the very beginning of the regime, in which people were classified according to class background. So it reversed the traditional hierarchy. So now you had children of landlords at the bottom and children of workers at the top, but that's become a self-sustaining kind of social caste system. I think actually George Orwell put it best in 1984 when he says, there have always been the high, the middle, and the low, no matter what system has been in place. And that's certainly what we see in North Korea.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. So there's also the issue, apparently, which the UN report, I believe the authors of the report in Geneva, this is the UN Human Rights Council, contacted the Chinese ambassador in Switzerland, or to the UN, and complained about repatriation of North Korean defectors and smugglers who go into China. And if they're repatriated forced back into North Korea, they're summarily executed. So let's talk about that relationship, because obviously when it comes down to referring the regime's leaders, as this report suggests, to the International Criminal Court, China is likely to veto it.
Yes, I think that's probably true. And the real question here is not what has gone on and what goes on in North Korea, because I think we are all more or less aware that the human rights situation is utterly abysmal. The question is, how can this lead to any serious action? And as long as China continues to protect North Korea for its own reasons of what they think of as their self-interest, their national interest, it's very unlikely that there can be any international action to address human rights. The Chinese government has said that North Koreans who enter China illegally are doing so for economic reasons, and they said that to the UN Commission on Human Rights in their letter last December. And they are not interested in directing criticism about human rights to North Korea, at least not overtly. It may be that behind the scenes, the Chinese would like North Korea to tone down some of what they're doing, but they're not likely to hand Kim Jong-un over to the International Criminal Court anytime soon.
So is there a reign of terror going on, as some reports have indicated, in North Korea? We know that there was the very public execution of the number two man in the regime, Kim Jong-un's uncle, and that was done in a very graphic and humiliating way.
and subsequent reports indicated that it may had a lot to do with control over some lucrative enterprises that the uncle controlled and that the son had ordered back into the control of the army, I believe, and the uncle had slow walked that, and the petulant new boy emperor, as he's referred to, had a sort of tantrum and offed his uncle. I mean, that's the, you know, there's a sort of Alice in Wonderland Mad Queen aspect to this that may or may not be true. So give me your version of what you think's happening there.
Well, I don't think there's a reign of terror going on at the general level any worse than there has been before. I think that at the top of the leadership, there has been a shakeup going on ever since Kim Jong-un came to power more than a year ago, and it seems to reach its climax with the humiliation and execution of his uncle by marriage, Chang Song-taek, in December. So if you are associated with the old regime of Kim Jong-un's father, then you should be very afraid of what might happen to you. It seems to indicate that there are people who are opposed to Kim Jong-un's assumption of power, or at least Kim Jong-un and those around him think there are such people. And we haven't seen much since the execution of Chang Song-taek. That might have sent the message that Kim Jong-un wanted, and he has been very careful to say that the policies of the regime towards China and so forth remain the same. So it really is about, it seems, a power grab and pushing out the old guard and those associated with Chang Song-taek and put into place by Kim Jong-un's father. It's pretty gruesome. It's worse than anything we saw under Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il. And we have to see whether that can be contained within this leadership, and it reflects really Kim Jong-un consolidating control, or if it's going to spill into a wider instability and a terror like we saw in the old days of Stalin in the 30s. So far, things seem to be reasonably stable, but we just have to see how it all plays out.
But Charles Armstrong, one of the many aspects of this report, apart from the documentation of systemic torture, execution, and these ubiquitous gulags that they have, it also singles out the state, quoting the report, has used food as a means to control over the population and deliberately block foreign aid for ideological reasons, causing the death of hundreds of thousands of people. So what's the logic there of that?
Well, it has to be kept in mind that although it was quite a brutal regime for a long time, things got much worse in the 1990s after the Soviet Union collapsed and North Korea's main economic lifelines were severed. The economic situation became catastrophic, and there was a famine in the late 90s. And since that time, food has been very scarce, and the regime has regulated the flow of food to people in order to keep the population politically in line. And certainly, there's lots of evidence that the authorities, including the military and the government, have blocked or directed food aid to the places they wanted to go. And, for example, keeping the military fed is more of a priority than keeping the population in the remote areas fed. There are places where misdirection of food aid has been worse in famine situations in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, for example. But North Korea has been a food aid recipient for now 20 years, and food has become a very powerful weapon in the hands of the regime.
So what is then the response of the donors? What the donors must feel some complicity in, not that they have any control over what happens to the food. So, you know, I know that there have been complaints during the Bush administration of that the food is diverted to the army, and that therefore why should we be giving food for humanitarian reasons? So it seems like it's a real conundrum.
Yes, it is. Not all the food is diverted, and you have to keep in mind that the army in North Korea is an enormous institution that is itself very diverse, and many men have to be in the military for over 10 years. So keeping the army fed by itself is hard to separate from giving aid to the population in general. There have been efforts ever since the 90s to monitor food distribution carefully, and I think, I've been involved in some of that myself, that it is, in general, getting to the right people. There are, of course, exceptions. I think if we stopped food aid altogether, it would not help the situation. It would just make it worse. And it wouldn't be the case that the people on top would starve. The regime would make sure that those who they wanted to kept fed would be fed. It would just be that more people on the bottom would starve.
So when the this UN report on systemic atrocities or state policy in North Korea, which the UN report refers to as unspeakable atrocities and systemic use of torture and execution and starvation. This report also, you know, makes references to Nazi-era atrocities and also goes to the whole idea of all of the subsequent revelations that happened after at the end of World War II of the full scope of the Nazi atrocities and this whole idea of never again and the extent to which people in it turned a blind eye to what was happening and didn't want to know about it, and the whole idea of a kind of shame on the international conscience of the world. So here's this report saying we can't allow this to happen again. Here's the evidence. It's absolutely in front of our eyes, and we simply can't turn a blind eye.
Yes, that is the case. And, of course, Nazi Germany is the sine qua non of an atrocious regime. You know, I don't want to by any means downgrade the significance of what's happening in North Korea, but at least the regime is not systematically exterminating whole classes of people, although the way the Nazis did, although, of course, for many groups, things are quite grim. It is important that we know. It's important that this comes to the world's attention. But again, it's just not clear what can be done to move things forward. Having that knowledge is one thing. Actually being able to take action to address these issues is another question altogether. We've taken the first step. It's up to those in the West, in China, in South Korea, and elsewhere to try to work together to make the situation better. We don't know what will happen in the future. At the present, it doesn't look like there's much that can be done directly. But over time, you know, I think this regime will have to open up more, and these issues will have to be addressed directly.
So in terms of the issue of bursting the bubble of propaganda and via these smuggle videos and now flash drives, what is the is the trajectory of that in terms of how long can the surveillance state control this sort of Orwellian narrative that's breaking down? Because you know, you can't argue that you're in a workers' paradise when your people are starving, and you can't keep the rest of the world out, comparatively speaking, because life in South Korea is infinitely better, and that is the reverse of the narrative that they're told. So it would seem to me that inevitably, and with China right next door, right across the river that they sort of sneak across all the time, conditions there are so much better as well. It is a real sort of black hole, and it's amazing how they've survived as long as they have. What is then, in terms of the dynamic between whatever the glue that holds this regime together compared to the kind of subversive nature of the reality of the outside world?
Well, they can't continue this sort of control of the population and of information much longer. We are starting to see cracks and fraying of this whole myth that has kept the population in line for 65 years. But still, the surveillance state is very powerful. It's almost impossible for people to organize. And no one is going to invade North Korea from the outside. This is a country now with nuclear weapons, and any sort of military action would be catastrophic. What seems to be the most likely scenario is if things continue to fray at the edges and the situation becomes so much worse in terms of how people perceive themselves, that there may be a faction of the elite that breaks away and decides they have to do something, they have to take the country in a different direction. Of course, that's exactly what Kim Jong-un is so afraid of, and that's why his uncle was executed. But eventually, there are going, you know, if we can't have an uprising from below, which seems to be very unlikely, under the present circumstances. We could have some sort of struggle from within the top leadership by instigated by people who realize it is in their interest as elites to change things. Otherwise, they're going to go down with this sinking ship.
And, of course, by executing the uncle, Kim shattered the whole myth of this godlike dynastic family presiding over this country.
Yes, and the way he did that was very dangerous because they've had this propaganda for decades that this is an enlightened family running the country, and Kim Jong-un's uncle was presented as this sort of guardian. And if he suddenly is outed as a subversive and a traitor, how can people have trust in the rest of the family regime as well?
Well, Charles Armstrong, I thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with the author of a report that indicates how the gutting of gun control laws led directly to a spike in gun violence and murders.